Hello and welcome to the Journal of Zoology podcast. I'm Anne Brough from the editorial office. In this episode, we talk about some of the papers published in January, February and March. Editor Virginia Hasen tells us about the unexpected benefits of a human-altered environment. I talk to authors Egon Heiss and Phil Center about their articles. We hear more from review author Paul Sherman. And lastly, I speak to Eduardo Arat to find out more about his research.
The squirrels gathered nuts, the sun shone on the leaves, the fragrance of the flowers sweet in the gentle breeze. The birdies were all singing, but they're not anymore. 'Cause I dug the whole thing up and built a big box store. Big box store.
That clip was from a Canadian band, The Arrogant Worms, with their song about digging up Mother Nature to build a big box store. Like The Arrogant Worms, we often think that human exploitation of natural resources is the greatest threat to wildlife across the globe. But what if building large concrete structures actually contributes to the natural world? This is the surprising conclusion reached by Louise Allen and her associates at Boston University and the University of Tennessee, when they compared the reproduction of bats rearing young in natural caves versus bats using precast concrete bridges in Texas. The bats they studied were Brazilian free-tailed bats. Large numbers of these bats migrate from Mexico to Texas each spring and congregate in huge maternity colonies where females give birth and raise their single young. Large numbers is hardly a superlative, as the natural cave they studied is home to over 400,000 bats. And the human-made bridge houses even more, about 600,000 bats. Bats may be small, but the bridge is not. It supports 8 lanes of traffic along a major interstate. What bat in its right mind would choose to raise a family underneath a highway bridge, exposed to the loud noises, vibrations, and fumes associated with thousands of cars, trucks, semis, and lorries driving by each day? One would think that the sensitive sonar system of the bats would be overwhelmed by such an onslaught, especially since the way moms identify their pups is by their calls. But apparently, the crevices in these bridges are excellent sites for rearing young. Bats born at these bridge sites are slightly larger in size and 5 to 10% heavier in weight than those at the cave site. They also grow 5 to 20% faster. In fact, pups raised under the bridge can fly on their own about 5 days before those raised in caves can take off. Why are the bridges so beneficial? Allen and her colleagues have 2 suggestions. First, the bridge sites are warmer than the cave roosts. That means bat pups do not have to spend as much energy keeping their body temperatures up and can spend more of their energy on growth. Secondly, the bridges are located in the middle of prime foraging sites in agricultural areas with lots of flying insects. Caves, on the other hand, are much farther away from prime agricultural fields. This means that moms using bridges as roosts don't have to fly as far to get food, and they can get food faster. Since a baby bat at birth is about 20% of its mom's weight, being close to food during pregnancy is a big plus. By using bridges, moms save energy too and can produce bigger pups and more milk. So it turns out that humans are managing to help bats by constructing large, warm roost sites in prime foraging habitat. Think about that the next time you drive across a large highway bridge. And if you want to read the entire article, it's called Birth Size and Postnatal Growth in Cave and Bridge Roosting Brazilian Free-tailed Bats, and was written by Louise Allen, Christopher Richardson, Gary McCracken, and Thomas Coons. Finally, the song by the Arrogant Worms is called Big Box Store and is from their album Torpid. Enjoy!
There is so much more at my big box store. It's my big box store. It's big, it's a box. It's my big box.
Thank you, Virginia. Being small and soft-skinned, amphibians make for easy prey. To avoid being eaten, many amphibians have evolved innovative means of protection. Salamanders in particular have a wide range of anti-predator mechanisms, from cryptic coloration and vocalization to poisonous secretions. Egon Hanks and colleagues investigated the bizarre defensive mechanism of one of the newts in this family, the Spanish rib newt. Hi, Egon.
Ah, hello, Anne. Nice to meet you.
The Spanish ribbed newt has a bizarre strategy to decrease palatability and increase survival rates. What exactly does the salamander do when threatened?
Well, the Spanish ribbed newt is actually a very interesting creature. When threatened, the newt secretes a kind of slippery and poisonous white viscous secretion onto the body surface. But apart from secreting toxins onto the skin, the Spanish rib newt goes a little further and, moves its quite long and sharply pointed ribs, which are normally directed backwards, forward. So these ribs can reach an angle of approximately 90 degrees, more or less, relative to the longitudinal body axis, and can so stretch the skin to the point of piercing it. The protruded ribs, they are very sharply pointed, as I already mentioned, and they can be used as kind of spears or just mechanical weapons to hurt an aggressor or potential predator. The Spanish rib newt can lacerate the oropharyngeal mucosa of this aggressor, or just sting into the mouth when this predator is trying to grasp the newt by the jaws or so, or is trying to swallow it or whatever. And as I already mentioned, the skin secretion is toxic, or is actually irritating on mucous membranes like the oral mucosa. But if brought into the bloodstream, it can be lethal. It is very, very toxic. So the ribs, actually used as mechanical or kind of mechanical weapons or stinging tools, they increase, if not potentiate, the effect of the skin secretion, and certainly decrease palatability this way.
What were the aims of your study, and how did you investigate this newt's anti-predator behavioral mechanism?
Well, we wanted to know how this anti-predator mechanism works. So, sometime earlier, we have carried out a study on the cutaneous, means skin, mucus, and poison glands of this newt. Yeah. And then we wanted to know actually more about this, weird rib penetration story. We wanted to know how the vertebral column rib complex is built up, which movements are required to pierce the skin with the ribs, and what is actually happening on the immersion point. Well, we wanted to know if there's a permanent pore, or we didn't know if the skin is pierced every time de novo, and this was not really cleared in the literature.
Yeah.
So to get this information, we applied different techniques, like X-ray imaging, to detect the rib position before and after a mildly threatening stimulus. And then we applied computed tomography to get data on the 3D morphology of the vertebral column rib complex. And finally, we also applied histological techniques to find out actually what's happening on the immersion point of the rib.
So what did you find out about how this mechanism works?
Well, that's a difficult question. Well, maybe the most interesting finding actually was that the newt actively moves its ribs forward, or rotates its ribs forward. The radius of horizontal rib mobility was surprisingly high, and the angle between rib and longitudinal body axis could reach different means between a relaxed and stimulated animal of a maximum of 65 degrees, and that's quite huge. And this actually smooth horizontal rib movement is enabled by the well-developed two-headed joint, which actually connects the rib with the corresponding vertebra. And this two-headed joint actually constrains dorsoventral deflection, but still enables a forward rotation of the rib. So that's a quite clever mechanism.
This sounds quite unusual. Is this mechanism found in other salamandrids?
That's a very good question, yes. Two-headed joint is actually found in most salamandrids, at least, or urodils. But such a movement of the ribs, what I know, could not be detected before. So actually the mechanism is there, and I'm quite sure that also other newts can move the ribs, but it seems to be of special importance in the Spanish rib newt.
What ideas do you have about the mechanisms preventing self-intoxication or microbial infection, which could result from the ribs piercing the skin?
Yeah, sure. Well, that's a very, very good question. And here, actually, I only can speculate. And first of all, we have to keep in mind that amphibians are known to have actually an extraordinary ability to repair the skin. So a wound can be closed or healed quite fast. And then it is known from other amphibians that their skin secretion contains antimicrobial peptides. And I think they are very probable to be present in the Spanish rib newt to avoid infections, and they are quite strong. For example, in the frog Xenopus, the peptide magainin could be isolated and could be shown that it's quite strong, not only against bacteria, but also against fungi and viruses. So it's quite strong peptide. And concerning the avoidance of any self-intoxication, well, I think there must be a kind of physiological, neurophysiological tolerance against the own skin toxins. Such a high tolerance against own skin toxins actually could be shown in the literature into other newts. So, however, as you can see, there is still a lot of work to do to completely understand.
Do you have any plans for future research?
Yes, that's actually a project that is in process. I would like to compare this creature, this newt, with the closest related ones. It means there are two species that are closely related. And I would like to compare them because there's the echinotriton that is also able to pierce its ribs out of the body, to pierce the skin with the ribs. And the third one is not able to do so. So that's quite interesting to try to explain why one is able to do so and the other is not, and what is behind of this, what is the evolutionary strategy behind all this.
Hurt yourself to hurt your enemy. New insights on the function of the bizarre anti-predator mechanism in the salamandrid, Pleurodiles waltel, by Egon Heiss and colleagues, is published in the February issue of the journal. Vestigial structures provide observable evidence for evolution. These rudimentary structures evolved from functional structures in an ancestral species due to a reduced selection pressure acting on that structure. Noting which structures have lost functionality can provide valuable insight into the evolutionary history of a taxon. I spoke to Phil Center from the Department of Natural Sciences, Fayetteville State University, to find out more about these structures in dinosaurs. So, how did you identify vestigial structures in the dinosaurs?
Well, to be considered vestigial, a structure had to be, by my criteria, extremely reduced with respect to its counterpart in close relatives. And not just one close relative, but I chose to use a series of at least three outgroups, which means they're less and less and less closely related. So if you can find, to use a term evolutionists hate, three more rungs on the evolutionary ladder, and the structure is not reduced, then that's a pretty good indicator that the non-reduction is the ancestral state. So if the structure is reduced in some other creature within that bracket, then it's tiny, then it's got to have been reduced.
So vestigiality is often thought of as being synonymous with uselessness. I noticed that this wasn't one of your identifying criteria. Why didn't you use uselessness as an indicator of vestigiality?
Uselessness. Well, as it happens, that was Darwin's first, when he came up with the term vestigial organs in The Origin of Species, he considered them useless, but nearly every vestigial organ that's been identified as useless in previous decades has now been found to have some use of some kind. So if you use uselessness as a criterion, you pretty much eliminated all structures out there from being vestigial. So what modern biologists do is kind of modify the uselessness criterion. In other words, the structure might have a function still, but it is useless for its original function. A good example, the wings of the flightless bird known as the cassowary, they've still got a function. It uses them in social displays, but they're useless as wings. And again, then the hind limbs of the python, there's these tiny little spurs. The creatures do use them. The male pythons spike each other during dominance contests, so there's a use, but they're useless as limbs. So I've done a similar thing here with the structures in dinosaurs.
So using your phylogenetic bracketing approach, which structures were identified within the dinosauria as being vestigial?
Well, there's a large number. Toes and fingers, there tend to be long lists of vestigial toes and fingers among the dinosaurs. Fifth toe becomes vestigial right from the beginning of dinosauria, and it even loses the phalanges later on in their evolution, so a few groups independently get even the metatarsal itself as being vestigial.
Mm-hmm.
And when it comes to fingers, quite a few groups reduced or even eliminated the outer fingers of the hand, digits 4 and 5. And in the intermediate groups, you see these things getting smaller and smaller and smaller, so obviously becoming vestigial.
Mm-hmm.
And in some groups, I find this extremely interesting, the sauropods, which are the big long-necked ones that are commonly called brontosaurs, they kept all the metacarpals of the hand, which are the hand bones,
mm-hmm.
but they reduced all the bones within the fingers. So the fingers have become vestigial while the rest of the hand has not.
What are the implications of this research?
One major implication has to do with change in function over time, especially in the limbs of dinosaurs, because these are where vestigial structures abound. So the fact that these things are getting reduced or lost suggests that major changes were occurring in the function of the limbs. In particular, the hand, with so many fingers being lost in so many different lineages, it makes it very obvious that the use of the hands in dinosaurs was very different from the use of the hands in their precursors. I guess the use of the hands would have to be different because dinosaurs primitively are bipeds, whereas their ancestors were quadrupeds. So lifting the hand off the ground would obviously change the function. And apparently it did so in such a way that the first three fingers were emphasized, and the last two apparently became unnecessary.
You covered vestigiality in the dinosauria very thoroughly. I don't suppose you have any future plans to research vestigial structures in other extant or extinct taxa.
Well, actually, I am working on that. I've found vestigial organs so fascinating that I've actually begun a study of them in extant taxa of vertebrates. So that's underway. It'll be a while before it comes out, but the mammals in particular and some others. Expect a survey of vestigial skeletal structures in mammals before too many years go by.
You can find out more about the vestigial structures Phil Center looked at in his paper, Vestigial Skeletal Structures in Dinosaurs, published in the January issue of the journal. Paul Sherman and David Wasser reviewed the problem of aging and lifespan of wild birds in the February issue of the journal. Paul Sherman speaks more about this interesting topic.
The puzzle of aging is this. If natural selection favors increased reproduction, then all else being equal, you would expect longer-lived individuals who have more opportunities to reproduce than shorter-lived individuals, to do better. So natural selection should consistently favor longer and longer and longer lifespan. But when we look across the animal and plant world, most animals are very short-lived. And so selection apparently has not been able to increase lifespan in all groups. And in fact, lifespans are, as I say, very, very short. So the question is then, why are lifespans short, and why do organisms senesce? And what I mean by senesce is decline in their physiological function, inevitably decline in physiological function as they get older. Why does this happen instead of organisms being at top peak condition throughout their entire lives and living long, long times? The idea that has come up and been now looked at in some detail. It began with Peter Medawar in 1952 and then was followed up by George Williams in 1957 and by Tom Kirkwood in 1977 and 2002. And the idea is that all the hypotheses for senescence propose that it's not something that is favorable. It is not a benefit to individuals, but rather it's an outcome of population demography that's affected by natural selection only indirectly. In other words, it's something that selection on individuals and genes cannot prevent. And the way to think about it is that as due to extrinsic mortality, that is mortality from parasites, pathogens, predators, food shortages, things in the environment that kill off individuals, due to extrinsic mortality, through time in any population, there will be fewer and fewer and fewer individuals at older ages. And therefore, anything, any physiological mechanisms that might crop up that would protect those old individuals are so rarely selected positively that they don't last very long, or that they are not promoted evolutionarily. So there's nothing to prevent deterioration late in life because there's been so little selection late in life favoring anything that would promote increased vigor and physiological function. I guess you could say it this way. An allele that prevented a mortality of a youngster, say a human, living from age 6 to age 7, would be consistently selected through generations. But the same allele that protected someone from living from age 100 to age 101 would very, very seldom receive selection. And so inevitably, any kind of deterioration that creeps in will stay there, you know, among the old, whereas among the young it will be strongly selected against and postponed. And so senescence begins at about the age of first reproduction and then continues on inevitably in all organisms due to this population demographic process. And there are several ideas of the actual underlying mechanism. One is the pleiotropic effects of good genes that have good effects early in life, bad effects late in life can be favored. Another is that maybe mutations accumulate late in life. And another is that maybe the physiological mechanisms promoting the survival of the body, the soma, are not favored late in life. It's not clear which of these exact hypotheses is right, although I put my money on what's called antagonistic pleiotropy. That is, good effects early, which have bad effects late, nonetheless are favored. But regardless, all three of the hypotheses of Medawar, Williams, and Kirkwood all have the same basic idea, which is that selection can't prevent senescence because of this population demographic phenomenon. We were interested in aging and senescence in birds. And the reason we were is that it is well known, it has been known for many years, that birds and mammals differ considerably in their longevities. And quite surprisingly, birds live much longer than similarly sized mammals. Now, the reason this is surprising is that birds have a higher, what is known as a rate of living. In other words, they have higher mass-specific metabolic rates. They consume about five times as much oxygen per gram of body mass as mammals. their body temperatures are 6 to 7 degrees higher, centigrade degrees higher, and their sugar, blood sugar, is 2 to 10 times higher than mammals. And so if one thought that senescence was just a rate of living burning out, birds should burn out much faster. That is, their heart beats so much faster, they ought to burn out quicker. And yet, that's just absolutely not true. Birds live longer. And so the understanding of the evolutionary hypothesis for senescence that I just talked about a minute ago suggests a reason. Perhaps it's because birds are able to escape forms of extrinsic mortality, in particular by predation, by flying away. And in support of that sort of an idea, flying mammals, that is bats, and gliding mammals, the flying squirrels and gliders, live longer than similar-sized mammals who don't fly and glide. So right away we think, aha, flying has something to do with avoiding extrinsic mortality due to predation. But here's where we step in. This was known, but where we step in is not all birds have long lifespans. And even among the birds that fly, that is not the penguins, for example, but all the flying birds, some live much, much longer than others. And so this study was designed to collect all the available information, I mean, everything that existed as of 2 years ago when we started this project, on the maximum life length of free-living and captive birds, and then to use that information along with information on ecological variables that have been suggested to affect extrinsic mortality, to see which of those variables seem to explain the differences in longevity among birds. Well, what we found, first of all, was that there are data on maximum longevities in the literature for 936 species of birds, and that's about 10% of all the birds on Earth. And among those, we found data on all the extrinsic variables as well as body mass and longevity for 470 species of birds in 40 families and 15 different orders. And this is about 5% of all the bird species on Earth we have this information for. The first thing we found that's interesting is that the longest-lived birds can live more than 30 years at the maximum, average maximum. And these are the flamingos, the parrots, the petrels, and the shearwaters. On the other end of the spectrum, the shortest-lived birds, which live less than 10 years on the average maximum, are the perching birds, the passeriforms, the grebes, and the woodpeckers. And they live, as I said, less than 10 years. And then the others are sort of intermediate. So you have the cranes and the waterfowl and the herons and egrets living between 20 and 30 years at the maximum. And the pigeons, the owls, the hawks, and the penguins and the shorebirds living 10 to 20 years on the average, the maximum. Now, for one of these orders, the passeriforms, the perching birds, we could look even within the order. We had enough data from different families to look at differences within that order. And we found that crows, the corvids, have the longest maximum lifespan, about more than 17 years, and the flycatchers and the wood warblers had the shortest lifespans, about 6 years. So overall, then, what we found is tremendous variation between orders, and within one order, the passeriforms, tremendous variation So then that amount of variation allowed us to, you know, using multivariate statistics, to ask the question, all right, what variables that might affect extrinsic mortality might account for these differences? And the variables we looked at were the diet of the bird, breeding latitude, the breeding insularity, in other words, whether nests on islands or on the mainland, the age of first reproduction, the breeding habitat of the bird, that is grasslands, scrublands, wetlands, woodlands, the nest location within the breeding habitat, whether it's aquatic, floating on water, or a cavity nest, ground nest, in a shrub or on a tree branch, its migratory behavior, and whether or not the population migrates, and finally, sociality, whether they are cooperative or breeders or colonial, cooperatively breeding or colonial nesting. And among those variables, then we put all of the variables, both for all the birds and then just for the passerine separately, into multivariate analysis using very powerful multivariate statistical techniques. And what we found was very interesting. About 80% of the variation in maximum longevity among the avian families were affected by, it was determined by four variables: body mass, diet, sociality, and breeding insularity. And briefly, the way it worked was that bigger birds live longer, so longevity increases with body mass. Longevity increases with the degree of herbivory in the diet. Longevity increases with sociality, the more social species. And longevity increases with breeding insularity, in other words, breeding on islands as opposed to the mainland. So the longest-lived birds, in other words, are big birds that are herbivorous, that breed colonially or socially, and that breed on islands. Now, why? Well, in terms of our interpretation of this under the evolutionary theories of senescence, is that, first of all, large birds have fewer predators because there aren't that many big predators that can bring down a very large bird. So a pelican or a flamingo has fewer predators than, say, a flycatcher or a woodpecker. In terms of herbivory, herbivorous species find a carpet of food that is not going to attack them back, and it's not going to give them parasites or pathogens. So it's not a dangerous food source, whereas a carnivore has to go out and catch its food, and the prey item may fight back and may give it parasites and pathogens which can be transmitted to the predator. In terms of sociality, social species have protection due to safety in numbers, due to mobbing, due to selfish herd effects. And in terms of island dwelling, there are fewer predators that live on islands, that live on the mainland. So the idea that large, herbivorous, social, island-dwelling birds are long-lived is right in accord with the evolutionary theories of senescence that say that when extrinsic mortality is reduced, lifespans lengthen because more individuals live longer and their physiological mechanisms that maintain function in those older individuals are more frequently selected. This sort of analysis definitely could be expanded to other groups, and I'm hoping that the exposure that the Journal of Zoology will give this work will help encourage that kind of an analysis.
Thank you, Paul, for providing such a thorough overview. You can read the full review, Avian Longevities and Their Interpretation Under Evolutionary Theories of Senescence, in the February issue of the journal. Many animals choose to migrate in response to seasonal changes in their environments. These migrations are usually linked to finding better feeding or breeding conditions. But why would you choose to migrate to an area where there is no food? Amazonian manatees do just that, as every year they undergo seasonal migrations to habitats where they apparently do not eat. Eduardo Arrat and colleagues investigated this paradox in their paper, The Lesser of Two Evils, Seasonal Migrations of Amazonian Manatees in the Western Amazon. What did you hope to find out about the migratory behavior of the Amazonian manatee?
The main thing was explain why Amazonian manatees migrate, particularly in the region of the Mid-Solimões River, and use this knowledge to look at what might be the situation of manatees in other regions of the Amazon, because the only information that we had, the sole information, was that they migrated in the Solimões region, which was a tracking data from Miriam Marmontel, which is another of the authors of this study. Mm-hmm. So we knew that they migrated there. So in this study, we extended the samples of animals tracked, discovered that they too did the same, had the same migration pattern as the data, the animals that we had previously. And then we went on to ask the question, but why do they migrate? And so that was the main objective, ecological, say, objective of this study, was why do they migrate?
What habitats are available to the manatees in this region of the Amazon, and how is this characterized according to seasons?
The main characteristic is that it varies immensely. For example, in Europe, you have winter, very cold winter, snow, and then you have summer, the seasons dictated by the weather. There, the seasons are mainly dictated by the water level. So, during the high water, which is June, July, mid-May, the water levels rise up to 14, 16 meters and flood hundreds of thousands of kilometers. All the forest is flooded, and so during this part of the year, the manatees have a big flooded area with lakes, but also flooded forest and abundant food.
Mm-hmm.
But when the water lowers, all this changes, and the only areas that remain flooded are the main river channels, a few lakes which are perhaps a bit deeper or a bit larger enough so that they don't get dry, but many of them lose connectivity. So differently from the during the high water, where a manatee could go anywhere, or a fish in the same way could go anywhere, the animals get confined to these small patches of water. And the fishes get confined to these areas. And because the fishes get confined to these areas, caimans aggregate to feed on the fish. Jaguars come to the margin to feed on the caimans and on the fishes. Humans come to fish. So for manatees to be in a place like that, where a place where the volume of water is very reduced and all your main predators are all around you, it doesn't mean that they will die, but it means that their situation gets as bad as it can get. So, and
right.
that is the difference, the main difference between the habitat during low and high water season, which would be something like winter and summer, but because of water level variation.
So it sounds like it would be very difficult to track animals moving through this kind of habitat. How did you monitor your manatees?
We monitor them using VHF telemetry. So we would capture them, which to capture them is quite a complicated process. We even call it an expedition. And then put the tag, the VHF tag on the manatee. Then we would release them from then on, because it is VHF telemetry, and because in that region with that kind of forest and water and all these, say, environmental conditions, our tracking, we get signals from perhaps 2 kilometers or 1 kilometer, depending on the local characteristics of the place. And I'm talking when you are on a boat. So we would have to be 365 days per year in the field. It's pleasant, but it is based on a lot of field work, the tracking of the manatees. And what makes life a bit more difficult with the VHF telemetry strategy is that suppose you have 3 or 4 manatees and they decide to migrate to different areas. It might mean that one crew and one boat cannot do the work because it's just too far apart. So you're always a bit limited on the sample that you can have of manatees at the same time because of logistical issues and financial issues and all that. Just the Amazon is, the area is immense, and it's like a labyrinth of lakes and rivers, and it's difficult to describe, but it's the closest I've seen to what one calls a labyrinth of, that is hard to find in the regions.
What did you find out about the migratory behavior and seasonal habitat use of these manatees?
Well, we found out that they tend to remain during the high water. They go to these, what we call várzea lakes. Várzea is the word in Portuguese, and it's an indigenous word for what in English people refer to as the floodplain. But a floodplain which is bathed by white water. During the high water in white water rivers, such as the Solimões, the manatees, they remain in floodplain lakes where they find lots of food and they eat and they spend, well, what we see is that they don't move much and they are close. We're never seeing them actually, but we're getting the signal and we know where the signal is because of triangulation. And so we know that they are there where the food is during the high water. When the water lowers, well, the data that we have shows that they wait until when it is almost the last moment for them to start migrating, perhaps because they want to eat more before fasting for 3 or 4 months. So they wait, and at a certain point they start migrating. So after being like 3, 4, 5 months not moving much inside a lake eating, they migrate from 80 to 200, 220 kilometers in 10 days or in 2 weeks until they arrive at this other kind of lake, which is actually a ria, which is a river that was, its end was flooded. And there they don't find food, but the lake, instead of being like a 2 per 2 or 3 kilometers or something like that, it's a 40 kilometer lake by 3 kilometer. And though it also, the water level also lowers there, it lowers less, and they still have ample aquatic space to stay there. So they, and then they stay during the low water there for maybe 2 months again. Then the when the water starts to rise again, they spread themselves through the floodplain going to the lakes where they had been during the high water, which is something else that we found out, which is called site fidelity. Mm-hmm. All the animals that we tracked, they always returned to the same floodplain lake during the high water and went to the same Ahia lake during the low water. So basically they aggregate during the low water in Ahia. They spread themselves through the floodplain into floodplain lakes during the high water. And the next season they aggregate again during Ahia. And then they spread themselves, and the rhythm is dictated by the flood pulse.
So what are the implications of this research from a conservation aspect?
Well, for example, something that already happened, which was because of the study that Miriam Armontel carried out previously and that they published in an abstract in a South American conference, and is that there are two reserves there, Mamirawa Sustainable Development Reserve and Amana Sustainable Development Reserve. Previously, Mamirawa Sustainable Development Reserve existed, and Miriam started tracking manatees in that area. When the manatees, when she discovered that the manatees migrated to Amana, this was one of the main arguments used to create the Amana Sustainable Development Reserve, because manatees were being protected half of the year and killed freely during the other part of the year. Mm-hmm. So because it is an emblematic species, independently of the manatee's ecological role, which is interesting, but perhaps as interesting as that of many other species, the thing is that the manatee has an appeal to society and it has an appeal to politicians. So it is a good it is a good animal to talk about conservation and the reality of our country now and of the area. And it has given us results in that respect, because when Amana Sustainable Development Reserve was created, and this is a reserve which is has more than 1 million hectares, I think a bit more, quite more than that, 1.3 million or so. Imagine how many other species were preserved in that respect, and also the lives of people in there, because it is a sustainable development reserve. So what we found now is that they migrate in that area, and we know that in other areas of the Amazon, the habitat dynamics is similar to that of our area. And we know that there are manatees in these other areas, and almost none of these other areas are conservation areas. Mm. And we know that the manatees, they are, the meat is cherished by the local population. There is no commercial hunting, large scale at least anymore. There is small scale, we know that. But also the question is, maybe they were killed so much that though their hunting pressure is not very big, but maybe there are not that many manatees anyway, so the pressure might be significant. So the idea now is that first is that we, with this work, we can suggest where manatees might be, for example, captured in other areas of the Amazon to be tracked, because this is, it's such a difficult animal to work in the field that, so we suggest that they should be looked for during migration to these channels of other Gila lakes of the Amazon during the lowering water. Mm-hmm. So at least it's a particular geographical area in a particular time of the year that if other people want to go there and track the manatees, they should go there. And this is our hypothesis, obviously, our conjecture. We also conjecture that they will migrate in a similar manner, because we explain migration in our area based on habitat dynamics. And we know from remote sensing techniques and field work in other regions of the Amazon that in these other regions that we make reference to in the paper, that the habitat dynamics is quite similar. So we conjecture that they will also migrate to the Gila lakes during the low water. They will also go to floodplain lakes or Vahzia lakes during the high water to feed on the macrophytes. And then we can use this knowledge to start thinking about creating other conservation areas in the Amazon for the manatees, so that we can start to think of them in an Amazon-wide perspective. Because there's a paper by Campagnetti that they discovered that Amazonian manatees in large part of the Amazon are a panmitic population. Mm. So because of this, we need to think of manatees, and because of several of the reasons, but we need to think of them on an Amazon-wide scale to talk about their conservation. And, which is very important also, always including the human beings that live in the area as an integrative and indissociable part of the conservation of the manatees. Because not only is they are the ones that kill the manatees, but they are also the ones that have the best option possible to preserve the manatees, because they are there every day of the year. Mm. And they helped us a lot in our studies. So part of the discovery of our study, which we mentioned in the paper, but which is not also based on statistical analysis, is more based on field experience, is that the human beings, the local human beings, are an indissociable part of the conservation of the manatees, which is good for themselves too, because truly one of the main reasons of conservation in the Amazon for us is also to better the lives of these people, so we can find a way for people to live in the Amazon and to use the good things that the Amazon has to offer, but without destroying the Amazon, but also without making their lives miserable. So it's working with the Amazonian manatee is working with human beings too.
Thank you for taking the time to explain this fascinating behavior of an extremely enigmatic and little-known species. You can read more about the migratory behavior of the Amazonian manatee in The Lesser of Two Evils, Seasonal Migrations of Amazonian Manatees in the Western Amazon, published in the March issue of the journal. That's all we have time for this episode. Thank you for listening. Please join us again for the next podcast, when we will hear about a selection of papers published in the April, May, and June issues of the journal.